Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
60 years after the decision to use the atomic bomb, a look at the decision to drop atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki with Professor Tsuyoshi Hasegawa, Director of Cold War Studies and involved in the University of Southern California at Santa Barbara. He's a specialist in modern Russia and Cold War history. We welcome you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Professor Hasegawa, I learned in school and many others also that the U.S. dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki to end the war quickly. You present a different view in your new book. Tell us about one part of it first. Why did the U.S. decide to drop the atom bomb to begin with?
Well, U.S. dropped the bombs to force Japan to surrender. I don't think that I'm different from the popular belief. But the motivation for that, I think the two things that you have to consider that, well, Truman, of course, obviously wanted to save lots of American lives. Again, this is not different. But at the same time, if he wanted to save lives, there are other alternatives available. I mean, this is basically two alternatives. That is that Truman could have modified the unconditional surrender in such a way to allow Japanese to preserve monarchical system. That's one option that he could have done. He did not do that. Secondly, he could have waited for the Soviet entry into the war. He did not do that. For various reasons, he did not choose those options, and that's a political reason.
Professor Hasegawa, since you've mentioned that he could have waited for Soviet entry, why do you think, one, they didn't, and how would Soviet of entry into the war critically created a sea change in the situation, perhaps forcing the surrender of Japan?
The Japanese policymakers came to the conclusion by the middle of June that Japan is not going to win the war. And so they started exploring the possibility of ending the war. Now, the United States demanded unconditional surrender, which Japan interpreted as the destruction of imperial institution, which the preservation of the emperor system was the highest of the values that the policymakers cherished. And therefore, they decided that they could not accept the American demand. So what was the alternative? The alternative was to go through the one remaining neutral country that remained neutral in the war, that is Soviet Union. So they approached the Soviet Union to terminate the war through Moscow's mediation. When the Potsdam Declaration, that was the ultimatum to Japan, was issued, two things very important. They demanded unconditional surrender. And secondly, Stalin's signature was not there. And therefore, the Japanese government decided, suspended the judgment on the Potsdam Declaration, and still they continue to rely on the Soviet Union. So that is the policy Japan pursued. And then Hiroshima bomb was dropped. Did Japanese government change the policy? No. Even after the Hiroshima bomb, Japanese government continued to rely on the Soviet Union. In fact, the foreign minister was sent an urgent dispatch telegram to Japanese ambassador, urging him that the situation is getting very urgent, therefore that you should really seek to meet the Soviet foreign minister to get an answer to the Japanese request for mediation.
What was Stalin doing during all this time? What kind of a strategy was he pursuing?
For Stalin was concerned, before that, in February 1945, there was the Yalta Agreement, and there the Roosevelt requested Soviet entry into the war, because at that time it was considered Soviet entry into the war was very essential to secure Japanese surrender. And so that Roosevelt requested Soviet entry into the war in return for certain rewards, that is concessions in Manchuria and some territories held by Japan. The condition is that in order to gain the rewards, Stalin had to enter the war. The problem was that there's a neutrality pact. In April, the Soviet government notified Japan that they are not going to renew the neutrality pact. But still, there's a notification. Still, neutrality pact was in force. And as the Soviet led Japanese believe, to use Stalin's words, lulled the Japanese to sleep in a while that he was making preparations to attack war. But he was determined to attack Japan in violation of the neutrality pact. But he needed some justification for the violation of the Neutrality Pact. Particularly, he didn't want to be compared with a Nazi attack in violation of the Non-Aggression Pact. And so he expected the United States and Truman to invite him to the ultimatum. Well, something happened. Well, in fact, that the United States, were in May, for instance, Harry Hopkins promised that this issue is going to be on the agenda of Potsdam Conference. But something happened, very important happened, that is the atomic bomb. That before the Potsdam Conference began, the United States succeeded in an atomic bomb test in New Mexico. And so that changed the whole thing. Now it became imperative for Truman to exclude the Soviet Union. And so there's a cat and mouse game at the Potsdam Conference there. And then Truman issued the Potsdam Declaration without Stalin's signature. And Stalin was convinced that the Soviet Union is outwitted. And so he immediately ordered the military to advance the date of attack on Japan. And so that there was a race. It's a very fierce race between Stalin and Truman, whether Truman could manage to drop the bomb, force Japan to surrender, or Stalin could manage to join the war. What happened was that, of course, August 6th, Truman managed to drop the bomb. You know, this was Stalin's reaction. Stalin came back from Potsdam on August 5th, one day before the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima, and he just immediately resumed the frantic activities, obviously in preparation for the war. And the next day, on the 6th, I got hold of this Stalin's appointment. Well, there's a frantic appointment. He met lots of people on August 5th, but none. August 6th, his appointment book was blank. That he was shocked. He thought that he just lost the game. And then, August 7th, the Japanese ambassador approached the Soviet foreign ministry and requesting the appointment. The game is not over yet. He again sprang to action. And he immediately ordered the Soviet army to attack 48 hours before that appointed day. Now, obviously, I mean, Truman expected Japan to surrender, but Japan still continued the previous policy. And Stalin just managed to join the war in the nick of time. And that was a very, very important moment for Japan's decision, because up until then, the Japanese government relied, hoped to terminate the war through the Soviet Union. Now that road was totally dashed, just that it was gone. And it was only then that the Japanese government began to really consider that the concrete terms of surrender and eventually accepted Potsdam terms and conditions.
Was there consideration on the U.S.'s part of choosing a military target rather than a civilian target to demonstrate the bombs?
The atomic bombs were meant to be dropped in the cities rather than military target. Well, actually, the cities with some military installations surrounded by civilians, because I think the most important thing is not really military weapon, but rather this is the bombs are supposed to shock and awe, basically, shock and awe. And so to the kill the civilians, as many as civilians, I think was a very, very important part of the strategy.
And you're also saying that the imperial system was so important to the Japanese that it really wasn't until August 14th till Manchuria is actually eaten up, gobbled up, as you put it, by the Soviets, that they actually understand and completely capitulate. I'm just trying to understand after the use of the atomic bomb.
That's right. I think it is very, very important to understand that the hierarchy of values that the enemies held. Because if you think that, okay, we are going to drop the atomic bomb, it's going to kill lots of people, so that the Japanese leadership would not tolerate that kind of damage. Well, that's not necessarily the way that the Japanese policymakers thought. Well, in fact, that a number of people, more people were killed in incendiary bombs. And the people, particularly policymakers, they were more concerned about preserving the imperial institution. There is a Japanese term, it's called koktai, which is the national polity. People didn't quite understand the precise meaning of it. But only then, when the Japanese government began to really discussing what we are going to preserve, Then I think this became very important. Upshot the whole thing that the Japanese emperor and the peace party decided the most important value that they have to preserve is the preservation of the imperial house.
So let me just get this straight, just to sum up. The U.S. had other options without massive loss of U.S. soldiers' lives to end the war. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. That was the only objective. Then Truman could have chosen other alternatives, and he did not.
Professor, where can people read more about this very critical issue and begin to set history straight with the critical implications of and results from dropping the bombs and what could have and should have happened to end the war? Your writings, please.
They can start from my book, Raising the Enemy, Stalin, Truman, and the Surrender of Japan, published from the Harvard University Press this year.
We are speaking with Tsuyoshi Hasegawa, who is the director of Cold War Studies. He's at the University of Southern California at Santa Barbara, and he's a specialist in modern Russia and Cold War history. And we've also been joined now by Greg Mitchell, who is a co-author of Hiroshima in America, an advisor to the award-winning film Original Child Bomb. And in a recent article titled Hiroshima Cover-Up Exposed, he wrote, in the weeks following the atomic attacks on Japan almost 60 years ago, and then for decades afterward, the United States engaged in airtight suppression of all film shot in Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the bombings. And why don't we begin with that? And we're just beginning to get some small portion of that footage revealed. Why has it been so long in coming?
The story in brief is that shortly after we dropped the bomb, the Japanese newsreel teams went in and shot the devastation and what happened to the survivors. The American military then came in during the occupation, seized all the Japanese footage, and locked it up and not really seen until around 1970. At the same time, they started their own filming and shot tens of thousands of feet of color footage of the devastation and the medical effects and the horrendous effects on human beings. And this footage was seen as too dangerous to release, and so it too was classified and locked up for decades and was not really seen by anyone again until the 1980s. And so it's only been the last few years that anyone has been using this in films, including the film I worked on that you mentioned. So during this extremely important period in our history, when the nuclear arms race was accelerating, we were setting off hundreds of atomic tests in the atmosphere over the United States, which later was determined to have killed eventually tens of thousands of people through fallout that fell on all of us then. And then we had the expansion of the nuclear power industry, the horrendous nuclear tests on people, which were exposed a few years ago, and then proliferation around the world as well. So this is an incredibly significant period in our history. And yet during this time, the only virtually every bit of film that was shot in the two cities, which were the only ones that have ever suffered an atomic attack, were kept from the American people.
What about news organizations? Did any news reporters get in there? Did they film it? What happened to that?
Well, I also, I'm the editor of Editor and Publisher, and I've published in the last couple months a number of articles, including one last week on film suppression. But before then, I broke the story in the U.S. of the first reporter who got into Nagasaki 60 years ago. George Weller of the Chicago Daily News wrote a series of stories about what he saw there, and they were killed by General MacArthur's censorship office in Tokyo and disappeared and thought to be gone forever. And lo and behold, Weller's son found them last year, and they were published a couple months ago in Japan. I guess they were still too hot to handle because no one in the U.S. was interested in publishing them even this year. But they did appear in Japan, and then I sort of broke the story at our website that they had appeared. So that was another example of the kind of suppression of the printed word. You know, they did allow some reporters eventually into the two cities, but they were subject to censorship. They did not go deeply into the human effects of the bomb. Really, the American public for many, many years were sort of kept in the dark on the true dimensions of the bomb and the human toll.
Mr. Mitchell, this is Toshi Hasegawa. May I ask you a question?
Sure.
I was really curious about this footage of Hiroshima and Nagasaki because I think there are lots of building and the after effects of the destroyed buildings and then factories and so on, but no humans.
Right.
And is that intentional? Or those the films that are kept secret, did they include that the human casualties?
Oh, absolutely. That's why they were kept secret. The little bit of footage that was released or that people could see during the 1950s and 1960s was all only of buildings. And you saw these landscapes of the devastation and taken from the air or from a certain height. It's not that people did not see any photographs or very, very tiny bit of footage of the physical effects. But what was kept from the people, and there's tremendous amount of footage in these, both the Japanese newsreel footage, which is in black and white, and the American military color footage, tremendous amount of footage of the human effects. In fact, again, this film that I worked on, Original Child Bomb, which is being shown on the Sundance Channel, includes some very graphic excerpts of some of this human footage.
Where did that the order for censorship come from? I mean, to what extent, how high that the order was involved?
What happened was the Americans were not, when they started the occupation, they were not aware what the Japanese were doing, and they just, the general headquarters, military, came across them shooting the film, and that's when they found out that they were shooting the footage, and it was seized, and then on orders of the Pentagon, and the people, I've actually been looking at this for about 20 years, and I became good friends with one of the, I guess he was third in command of the U.S., the people who shot the American footage, and then I also interviewed the man who was in charge of the American footage and the Japanese footage, and basically kept track of all the footage for decades. I interviewed him as well, and they both wanted the footage out. They felt it was a real warning to the world. They felt that unless you really were in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you didn't really understand the dimension of this. They tried to get the footage out for many years, but the man who directed the whole enterprise, Lieutenant McGovern, told me, he said it was, of course, the Pentagon and the Army, the Air Force, and so forth, but he said that the Atomic Energy Commission was the real culprits. They were the ones who really were behind the American testing and the development of more nuclear weapons and so forth, and they really didn't want this out at a time we were developing and testing new weapons all the time.
Well, I think that it makes sense because I think that the U.S. government was very, very nervous about the effects of atomic bomb, and immediately after that, I mean, there was an attempt on the part of, say, Truman and Stimson to create a myth that the atomic bomb was necessary and justified,
right?
Despite the fact various criticisms,
right.
47 it's a famous article written
by Harper's Magazine.
Yes. That was sort of preempt that this became sort of orthodoxy.
Right.
And so it all makes sense to me.
Well, the book that I wrote with Robert Lifton, Hiroshima in America, focuses on that. We have a lengthy chapter on that Harper's article and the whole first 5 years. It really kind of focuses on the first 5 years, although it goes through the entire history. But it really looks at how what we called the Hiroshima narrative was established. And this was the narrative that the bomb was necessary to prevent an invasion and to save American lives. And it was quite a moral act because it saved lives. It didn't take so many lives. So it was important for people to think of this as just another military action, not something that would usher in a new era or that would be used. You know, here we are 60 years later, and other nations around the world that are interested in nuclear weapons or have nuclear weapons sort of still point to this act and say, geez, where is America to get on its high horse about nuclear weapons when you're the only ones who have used it? Mm-hmm. So it was important that the narrative focus on the alleged usefulness of the bomb in allegedly ending the war. Now, I know you've talked about, and other people have talked about, the importance of the Russian entry into the war, which Americans know almost nothing about, and so forth. But the narrative was that only the bomb could have ended the war, and in fact did end the war. So, but another reason for keeping this footage secret was that it showed quite graphically something else, which most Americans do not accept. You know, part of this Hiroshima narrative was that Hiroshima and Nagasaki were military bases, were military targets, and in fact, were military, really hard military targets, you might say. And as this footage of the human effect shows, the vast majority of the victims were women and children. As we now know, there were virtually no Japanese military in Nagasaki. And there, although there were maybe 15,000 who were killed in Hiroshima, Hiroshima was not primarily a military base. 90% of the victims in Hiroshima were civilians, and most of them women and children. So this footage shows, you know, it's one woman and one child after another with their horrible wounds and radiation effects. And it's, you know, it just brings that home.
I think that I agree with you that I think this Hiroshima narrative, I think, served as a vehicle to keep the Americans from asking a really fundamental moral questions about dropping on Hiroshima. But another side effect, that is that dropping on bomb on Hiroshima gave the Japanese a sense that they are also victims of war, of the war.
Right.
And that prevented, that has, I think, so far in my opinion, has prevented Japanese from asking a fundamental question about their moral responsibility for starting the war and committing various atrocities.
Right. I think that's absolutely right. The survivors of the bomb that I've interviewed, a great number of them, you know, they don't take that approach. They're very willing to condemn their own country and condemn all movements that their own government has made to cover up Japan's crimes and so forth. So that is not a sentiment that the survivors have, but of course many others in Japan have seized on the victimhood or the martyrdom to not look so deeply at their own very sordid past.
This is very interesting because after Nagasaki, the second bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, Truman issued a statement to the effect that he said that we have discovered a bomb, we have used the bomb against those who attacked Pearl Harbor and against those who treated American prisoners of war very cruel manner.
Right.
Those two things are quite understandable. But he said, he added another very interesting thing. He says, against those who threw away all the pretense of observing international law in warfare. And that is very striking because when he used that, never occurred to him that the dropping the bomb was a violation of international law.
Right. I mean, what you still hear today is, of course, this was not something new. This is a continuation of the bombing of cities, which had gone on for years. And, I mean, it's a funny kind of defense to make when they say, you know, and you say, well, it's just, we'd been already doing this kind of thing, but just not with a radioactive bomb. So it's a funny, I'm not sure people should be reminding how many hundreds of thousands or millions of people we incinerated with our conventional bombs. But the context is that the atomic bombs were just something different, you know, a little different and bigger, but nothing that new. And I'm sure that's how they wanted to see that, and that there was a certain logic to it. If you're going to accept the burning of Dresden and 20 Japanese cities before this, don't get too excited about the atomic bomb. But even if you accepted that, nevertheless, the lesson and the message it sent to the rest of the world about nuclear weapons not being taboo. I mean, that's what kills me every year when the subject is brought up in the media and officials and so forth. And, of course, everyone says, we must never have a nuclear war. We must never use nuclear weapons again. It's taboo. But yet at the same time, they defend Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which sends out the message that you can make exceptions to that rule. And so just the mere fact that we used them and then have for 60 years have defended it would seem to suggest that we think that there is a place for nuclear weapons and their first strike capabilities.
In the remaining time that we have for this segment, Greg Mitchell, co-author of Hiroshima in America and advisor to the award-winning film Original Child Bomb, again tell us where we can see the film and perhaps a wrap-up comment and similarly Professor Hasegawa.
Again, the film was debuted this past Saturday on the Sundance Channel. It was at the Tribeca Film Festival last year, actually, and has been shown at festivals around the world. But it debuted Saturday night at the Sundance Channel, and it's going to be repeated all this week at different times. You'd have to go to the Sundance website, and you'd see all the different times. As far as a wrap-up, I would just say that it's important to keep looking at this looking at this issue. We still, this year, my article about this film suppression and and the film. I was interviewed by dozens of print and radio stations, but very little TV. And so this footage, even after all this time and despite wide publicity now, still has not been widely seen. So there still seems to be a lot of interest in the subject, certainly interested in my print stories, but still a reluctance to show the footage. And I guess the struggle continues.
Indeed. And Professor Hasegawa?
Well, I agree with Greg Mitchell. I think there is a fundamental difference between conventional weapons and the nuclear weapons. And I think this is something we have to keep in mind. And then also, if you take a look at the ultimate decision, how the decision was made to drop the bomb, then I think that we really have to confront the very fundamental moral issue of the decision.
We've been very graced in our studio to have Professor Tsuyoshi Hasegawa from California here, and I do encourage people to get the book, which again is called
Racing the Enemy, Stalin, Truman, and the Surrender of Japan.
And Greg Mitchell, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. We thank you for your perseverance in your work. And we insist that before we get to the 61st anniversary, that the footage is revealed. And thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
And for Building Bridges, your community and labor report, I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.